Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Overall reading and math proficiency rates remain stubbornly low in the latest round of Delaware student testing.
That could be a rounding error. That's like no growth. It's not going backwards, but it's not the kind of growth that Delaware students deserve. And frankly, what I've seen in terms of some of the bright spots where there is possibility for growth, I want to see more of that.
State Education Secretary Cindy Martin joins us to discuss the numbers and how to improve them. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from a University of Delaware student who studied the recent Texas floods and the response to them. Arts Playlist takes us to the Biggs Museum for an exhibition focused on HBCU marching bands. And Enlighten Me looks at UD's move up in college football. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware's 2025 statewide student assessment results reveal only a 1% increase in math and reading proficiency rates for grades 3 through 8. Relatively stagnant test scores have become a familiar theme for the first state, as school districts continue to work on making up for COVID learning loss and return proficiency rates to pre-pandemic levels. This struggle persists while the state is in the process of overhauling its core education funding formula in hopes of making more equitable investments and improving student outcomes. This week, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich spoke with State Education Secretary Cindy Martin about her reaction to the latest assessment scores, how the state is moving forward, and what countywide reassessments mean for the new funding formula.
Well, thank you so much, Secretary, for taking the time to talk a little bit about education test scores funding in Delaware. So starting off, want to reflect a little bit on the statewide assessment numbers that were just announced. So I know you said in a statement that no one should be satisfied with these scores. It looks like in English and math proficiency, rates rose, you know, around 1%, if not remained stagnant in most cases. So I want to just get your initial reactions to these scores and you kind of flesh out your process in determining what does this mean for the state of education in Delaware.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you definitely got my quote. That's what I said. No one should be satisfied with these results, and really a 1% gain, percentage point gain on each of the two sections that we assessed is that could be a rounding error. That's like no growth. It's not going backwards, but it's not the kind of growth that Delaware students deserve. And frankly, what I've seen in terms of some of the bright spots where there is possibility for growth, I want to see more of that. And we're going to build on those bright spots. Delaware has done a lot in terms of investment and a lot in terms of being able to prepare and support, but it's not translating to these scores. And so getting underneath that, at the end of the day, a test score like the SBAC, that's the test that Delaware takes annually. It's third through eighth grade, and then the SAT scores in 11th grade. That's a once a year assessment, and that is an assessment of learning. It's the assessment that happens at the end of a school year, and I'm making a distinction between an assessment of learning and an assessment for learning. Teachers in the classroom every day use assessments for learning that give them direct, immediate feedback on, I just taught a lesson, is a student learning? Is a student reading on grade level? If we wait for the end of the year test, the assessment of learning, the lagging indicator, the autopsy, that's what you call an end of the year test in simple terms, it's too late to do anything about it. What we need is to build the systems of excellence day by day in the classroom so teachers get real-time feedback in their teaching, and that you're building time for teachers to work together, to be able to look at real-time data on students and not wait for the end of the year assessment. That's too late to do anything about it. And so I take it as something that we look at and say, where do we see systems and pockets of excellence? And then how do we build from that? But I want to actually dig into support for our classroom teachers and make sure they have the tools that they need every single day, and not the once a year assessment, but the daily, weekly, monthly, that principals in Delaware can be instructional leaders that are in supporting their teachers in the building to have the tools and the resources that they need for students to learn and have the kind of academic growth that they deserve. So we see where the potential is for growth.
Yeah, I want to touch a little bit on what you said about looking at the bright spots. So I'm curious, do you think that moving forward is the path looking at Delaware school districts that have been successful in seeing growth and adopting those policies? Or do you think we're at the point now where it might behoove us to look outside the state, you know, even further and try to find more resources or more tools that other states are seeing success with?
Well, I don't usually deal with either ors, so I'm going to say yes, both. It's not going to be one or the other. And it's really hard to even have a conversation saying that there's a bright spot, because even the bright spots are still not proficient the way students need to be proficient. And so I don't want to sugarcoat this in any way. I got to give it to you sugar-free, like we like to say, and say where we are is not okay, and nobody is satisfied with this. And so I got to be crystal clear when we lean in on a bright spot. It's not to say, yeah, but there's a five alarm fire over here. The governor and I declared this emergency when we started, from day one of our administration, and these test scores backed up the fact that there is an emergency and we must work on it. And so when there's a five alarm fire, we don't talk about, oh, we better get a better smoke alarm. We put that fire out. We need to lean in on that. And the solutions, the fact that there are bright spots and solutions in Delaware, yes, lean in on that. But this is never a copy paste approach. You don't say, okay, well, over here they haven't figured out, so cut, copy, paste, and just do what they're doing over here, whether that's in Delaware or whether that's across the country, whether that's in DC or California, where I'm from, or Mississippi, where people want to talk about the Mississippi miracle, which when you talk to the Mississippi, they'll say it's a marathon, not a miracle. It does not happen overnight. It is sustained investment in supporting educators in the classroom to have the high quality instructional materials that they need. Delaware has laid the groundwork. The Delaware General Assembly has already laid the tracks for high quality outcomes for students in terms of passing the science of reading and other things, that investments that can actually be leveraged to make a difference. But now we need skillful implementation of the practices that we know work in the classroom. And proximity matters. When I say proximity, I mean you got to get closest to the problem that you're trying to solve. So Dover is about, well, Washington, D.C., or the national level, or out answers from outside is about as far away from the problem that we're trying to solve. Get into the classrooms, support the superintendents, the school boards, the principals, to be the instructional leaders, to ask the right questions, to direct the right supports, and give teachers the tools that they need and the knowledge and skills to use those tools. I mean, you can pass out the very best tools that are available to education and say, okay, everybody has the right tools. Well, that's like going to Home Depot and buying, well, maybe I shouldn't use name brand, going to a store and buying the fanciest circular saw there ever was invented, the most expensive tool there is. And we know that circular saw makes the most beautiful handmade wooden table, or whatever you make with a circular saw. I can't just buy that tool and then make the table. I actually need coaching, guidance, support. How do I use this best-in-class tool? So Delaware has all of the makings for sustained systemic growth that is actually owned by the very educators doing the work. And that means we invest in our teachers, and we give teachers those kinds of training and support. And they need instructional leaders in the building. They need principals who understand how to move student achievement and how to implement aligned resources aligned to the science of reading. How do you put assessments in place? So I could sit and talk about the test scores all day long. That's the end of the year test. I want to talk about in the classroom every day, getting teachers, if whether it's the letters training that's tightly connected to their lesson materials, whether it's the early literacy leadership academies. We call it ELLA, which is a really cute acronym. I actually like that. The Early Literacy Leadership Academies, that gives our school principals and their coaches, there's literacy coaches that know how to push into a classroom. Give me your most challenging student. You're a fourth grade teacher, and you have half your class or 100% of your class reading at the first or second grade level, and you don't know what to do. What is that fourth grade teacher supposed to do? The SBAC scores are in, but now what do I do? And so we don't want to talk about the problem and just admire the problem. We want to actually lean in with a coach. So through our ELLA, Early Literacy Leadership Academies, we can unpack that. We can put in a student-centered coaching cycle where we walk into a third grade or fourth grade teacher's classroom where they say, we're stuck. We don't know how to move these students. They're three grade levels below reading. What do we do? Well, we then actually do side-by-side coaching, and we show how to make growth for students that are struggling. We also need early warning systems. We need indicators around students that are struggling with dyslexia. We've passed legislation to identify that. Do we identify the kids that have dyslexia? Are we identifying them holistically and systematically statewide? And then it has to go beyond identify them. What are we going to do about it? Do you have the tools and resources to put in place? And so all of that is like how you build a very deeply braided support system to address this, that there is not a quick fix, there's not a silver bullet, and there is an urgency to it like I've never felt before in my career.
Talking about funding on a larger level here, obviously the big question in Delaware is how do we systemically reform education funding here? And we just recently had a special session that was aiming to fix some problems following a reassessment. And there was some controversy around schools being able to take up to a 10% revenue increase following a reassessment. Obviously, schools haven't been able to utilize this provision in decades because Delaware has not conducted reassessments on a regular basis. So I just wanted to get your perspective a little bit. There was legislation introduced that would require schools to prove a deficit in order to take advantage of that increase afterwards. That bill did not go through, so now they're still allowed to, use their discretion to see how much they want to raise following a reassessment, which is causing some, issues here for taxpayers because they have some higher tax bills that they weren't expecting. But also there's this larger question of schools have historically been underfunded in Delaware, right? So I just wanted to get your take on following the reassessment process and this special session. How do you feel about this conversation around the 10% piece? And do you see that as an important discussion point moving forward when it comes to education funding reform?
Well, you just outlined it very clearly, the current state of play. Nice job homework, doing your homework there, Sarah. Those are the large contours of where we find ourselves. And so unpack that a little bit. And first of all, just start with the how people are feeling about the sticker shock of the new higher tax bills, and that when you have not reassessed property taxes in so many years, there will be a result to that. And that's what people are seeing. And so you can unpack all of that. That was all news to me when I got to Delaware. I didn't know the history on that, but I've definitely given myself the fastest history lesson I can, so I understand kind of the current situation. At the end of the day, let's remember where this came from was the NAACP lawsuit around funding in Delaware and the Public Education Funding Commission and Governor Myers' commitment to a more equitable funding mechanism for how we fund our schools, because that does not currently exist. We have an old way of funding schools that is not equitable. When I define equity when it comes to school funding, it's making sure that where there is greater need, there is greater investment. And that is not currently the way it happens. So to understand equitable funding and what every state that has worked on this, it turns into a weighted student formula. And a weighted student formula means that where there's greater need, there's greater investment. So multilingual learners, low-income students, students with high needs for students with disabilities, you could say military-connected youth, you could say foster and homeless youth, that when there's greater need, there should be greater investment. And so it began with this property tax reassessment, began as part of the decision or the agreement in the lawsuit, was that Delaware needs to reassess its property taxes so that we actually understand the lay of the land. And once that's all been said and done, and right now I know that's being figured out, what fair shares are people paying and how the role is going to be split. But when that all is decided, then we will see that there will still be, I don't know what the right word is, like tax deserts or places where the local tax revenue does not support the need for the schools that the students that attend those schools. And that's where an equitable student funding formula can address that. At the end of that lawsuit, part of the other agreement was to, that's where opportunity funds came from, to try to make more equitable funding. The state had to agree to put money into an opportunity fund. That was beginning to move the state towards a more equitable funding formula. But the entire property tax reassessment is the bigger picture of overall full education funding reform. And so at the end of the day, the 10% that the districts can do as a part of this reassessment, that's a small piece, small but important piece of the puzzle. The bigger piece of the puzzle is a more equitable student funding formula. As you know, you've been following the PEFC. We've talked about the hybrid model funding formula. What will that look like? What part of the unit count is maintained? What part of equity gets built into that? How do we unveil a formula that moves forward in Delaware that takes into account the property tax that's been reassessed and what the new lay of the land is? The idea that you would even need opportunity funding anymore, you wouldn't need that to be layered on because you actually get the formula straight from the start. And the tax bills that people are seeing increases on, I would argue would probably be more because their property value has gone up by a tremendous amount. That is what is the majority of the tax bill going up, not whether a district did whatever percent they did within the 10%. That was part of it. It's part of the puzzle. But all of that is being worked out now. And I want to keep my eye on the prize. At the end of the day, does Delaware walk away from all of this change that was needed and spurred by the fact that schools were not equitably funded? Does Delaware walk away with a more equitable weighted student formula that maintains the kinds of guardrails that we know schools need to have the staff and the supports that they need, but also brings in resources into parts of the city or parts of the state that do not yet have equitable funding, if not for a few more dollars because of opportunity funding or a few more dollars because of multiple efforts that the General Assembly has courageously put through? I mean, there's been courage in getting equity to the places that need it, but it hasn't been a holistic systemic approach. It's been layered on and layered on and layered on, and it's layered on top of the fact that property taxes were off. And so get those right, then see what you have, and then figure out how to build a holistically equitable funding formula for Delaware students because they deserve it.
Thanks to Delaware Education Secretary Cindy Martin and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We hear from a University of Delaware doctoral student who traveled to Texas following last month's deadly flooding to study the response and what can be learned from it. That's next, here on The Green, on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last month's flooding in Texas killed over 130 people, with Kerr County seeing the most damage and deaths. In the aftermath of the flood, the response to the disaster came from far and near, and included University of Delaware doctoral student Julie Elliott as she studied the disaster response. This week, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry sits down with Julie Elliott to discuss the scene in Texas right after the flooding and the recovery response, as well as what can be learned about improving flood response in the future.
How did the chance to go down to Texas after the flooding, how did that come up? And was it something that you just did on your own, or were you asked to go?
Sure. So I am from Texas originally. I'm born and raised in North Texas specifically. I was in Delaware for a few years while I was getting my PhD. I'm still working on that, of course. Specifically, I'm in the dissertation phase. And so when I wrote my dissertation proposal, I knew that I wanted to focus on Texas because I have a lot of connections in this area. I used to work as an emergency management practitioner in Texas. So it's just an accessible area to me to do my dissertation. And so I wrote it into the proposal that I would be focused on Texas. And I also wrote an additional provision into the proposal that if there were a disaster event that took place in the state of Texas, that I would potentially, depending on the context of the event, the various conditions surrounding the event, I would consider deploying for quick response field work. And quick response field work specifically is research that's designed to collect perishable data, essentially data that you wouldn't be able to collect if you were to wait longer after the event happened. Perhaps people's memories fade, posters that were hanging up are taken down and discarded, various damage that you would not see once it was cleaned up. So I wrote that into my proposal that I would potentially go down. And my research is specifically focused on how organizations collaborate, how they build networks, and how they maintain those networks before, during, and after disasters. So when this event occurred back on July 4th, I immediately, of course, it was an event that happened in Texas, but even beyond that, I have family that lives about 40 minutes from Kerr County, Texas. And I determined that this would be a good event to go to because I would be able to stay with my family and not impose on the local jurisdiction. I wouldn't have to use local housing because I'd be able to just stay with my family and I would have my own personal vehicle. So there would also not be the burden of renting a car and using other resources from the community. Additionally, because my work is focused on how organizations collaborate and work together, it was very obvious, even in the hours after the initial initial flooding occurred that there was going to be a lot of organizations responding to this event, and organizations not just from Texas, but from across the whole country, and you could even say across the world. There's been international groups that have responded as well. And so it immediately presented itself as a great opportunity to learn about collaboration and see how these groups work together. So immediately I got in touch with my faculty advisor at the University of Delaware, and we met to talk through the logistics of going down there. We talked through, you know, some ethical considerations, things to keep in mind as I'm going into this community. And kind of once we had sorted that out and I felt equipped and ready to go, I deployed down there by myself. And during that time, I primarily did observation work. So it was data collection via observing, but also document collection and taking photos in places that it was appropriate to take photos. Again, primarily focused on how organizations were working together during this event.
When you arrived in Texas, were you essentially assigned an area that you can go, or were you able to kind of just go here, there, and anywhere on your own?
I was essentially able to go to wherever I essentially needed to go. The community at this stage, I went, the event happened, I believe, on a Friday, and I was down there on the following Thursday. So it had only been 6 days later. So the community was still reeling from this event. And it was very, very obvious that search and recovery operations were ongoing. There was evidence of that everywhere. And folks were very, very busy, which is primarily why I did observation work and not interviews, was I didn't want to impede or obstruct any of those operations that were ongoing. But because of that, I was essentially able to act as a fly on the wall in several places and just observe the activity happening there. And on that note, too, there were certain places that initially I had planned to go to observe. But as I learned more about the context of those areas, I decided it just wasn't ethically appropriate for me to go into those places. So there was often a decision made at a moment's notice where certainly no one was going to stop me from going into certain areas, but it just was not relevant to my research. And even if there was a level of relevance to my work, it just wasn't the appropriate time. And so I do have intent to go back a couple months down the road and see how things have changed as it moves into long-term recovery. I mean, when I do that, I think there will be opportunity to go into some of those areas that I decided was not ready for a researcher to go into. So, and a lot of that data can be collected via interviews later on once the initial response has kind of calmed down a bit.
Can you go more into what you saw down there and what were the conditions like that everyone was facing?
Sure. So on my way down there, just driving there, I noticed there was still a lot of storms happening in and out of the area. There were certain days. One of the days I was there, it was actually my last day, they received flash flood warnings again. And so they had to halt the search operations because of that, because it just simply wasn't safe to be along the river. The trees in this part of Texas are enormous. This is a hill country, is some of the most beautiful area of Texas. And it just has these enormous towering trees. And at one point during the trip, I did go down to the river. I walked through a mobile home park that had been destroyed. And you see these trees either completely uprooted, or if the tree miraculously held on to the soil, it was bent at a 90 degree angle. And that was just sobering, shocking, just really, you can't really wrap your mind around the force and power that the water had. And of course, the mobile home park itself was there, really, it was hard to know that that's where you were because the damage was so severe in these areas. And on top of that, you know, Texas is known for being hot, and it was certainly very, very hot there. And the humidity on top of it was very rough on the responders there. And so there were lots of relief stations set up just for the responders to get food, to get water, to get hydrated and take a break. And I heard reports of folks encountering snakes and other dangerous debris. So there is a lot of additional hazards on top of just the flood itself.
Was this the first time you've responded or gone to a like a disaster site as part of a research, or have you done it before?
Yeah, so this was my first experience doing quick response field work directly related to research. I used to work as a practitioner here in North Texas, so I was involved in some response operations in response to the winter storm that we had back in 2021, the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, and then smaller incidences that happened in this area. And my initial foray into emergency management was volunteering in tornado impacted areas in high school. And so I had seen that kind of damage before. This was my first exposure doing field work related to research. And this was certainly even though I've seen disaster debris, I've seen the damage that events can cause. This was another level of shocking beyond what I had seen before.
Is there anything else that really stood out to you as part of either your research or just a personal observation from this flooding aftermath in Texas?
Yeah, I think that this particular event has resonated with people across the entire country. And I think it has, in part, that might be given the media attention. But also, I think that, I have a 10-month-old son, and hearing some of these stories of parents who lost their children, it's just absolutely, heartbreaking. And I think that those stories that came out of this event have really impacted a lot of people more in a very, very deep, in a very personal way. And so with that in mind, when I was there, the levels of altruism and outpouring of generosity that I saw were just really amazing. There were, I believe the final report is, over 25 states, aside from Texas, responded to this event and offered their support via first responders or emergency managers. I think that it was amazing to see the manpower resources that were committed. There was definitely there's an overwhelming amount of donations that are coming into the area, which certainly causes, there's coordination challenges that come with that. But what really stands out to me is just how moved people are by this event and how much they're willing to give. And I definitely witnessed just an incredible amount of collaboration between organizations working to address the needs. And I think that this recovery is, we think about it as cyclical, but it really should not be seen as a cycle. Recovery is a discrete point in time in which a community is changed permanently, in my opinion. And so from my perspective, I think this is going to be a very, very long road of discovering what is the new normal for Kerr County and the surrounding areas.
How does the flooding that we saw down in Texas help places like Delaware prepare for flooding issues like we saw in Wilmington a few years back along the Brandywine?
I think that there's a lot that can be learned from this event, a lot of considerations to make. And I think that it's important to remember to not be complacent whenever you're thinking about hazard events. This is an area that gets flash flooding a lot, but this is obviously was unprecedented flash flooding. And you have to stay vigilant at all times, realizing that the unprecedented could happen at any time, and take measures now to prepare yourself, to prepare your family, but also to get involved in your community and look at ways that you can build resilience at the community level. Because we know that these faith-based groups, the community-based organizations that exist in the community are going to do a lot to lead the way if a disaster occurs. And so we need to be taking actions now to fortify those groups, to give resources, to think through what's the plan and how will we be involved? How can we best work in that space? Being prepared is really, really critical. And I think just not being complacent is extremely important.
Thanks to University of Delaware doctoral student Julie Elliott and our Joey Rosari for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to the Biggs Museum in Dover for more on an upcoming exhibition focused on HBCU marching bands. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This weekend marks the beginning of college football season, and for many, a big part of any college football experience is halftime. That's when college marching bands take center stage, and some of the best in the nation are marching bands at historically black colleges and universities, like the Approaching Storm at Delaware State University. This fall, the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover celebrates that HBCU band tradition with a new exhibit called Battle of the Bands, with art by New Orleans-based artist Keith Duncan. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny talks to the Biggs Museum's Director of Learning and Engagement, Kate Huffman, and its chief curator, Laura Fravel, about this exhibition.
Let me start by just asking one of you to tell me about this exhibition and what can people expect to see?
The exhibition is called Keith Duncan, Battle of the Bands, the HBCU Marching Band Series. It's organized by the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and it is coming to us through Art Bridges, which is a national nonprofit that helps connect museums so that they can travel their collections and shows. And one reason we wanted to chase this show is because we in Dover are home to Delaware State University, which is nationally ranked as one of the top HBCUs. So even though the show is focused actually on Southern marching bands, I think there's a lot of local connections. The show itself is 45 pieces, most of which focus on these bands. There are 15 universities represented across the South, and 15 of those pieces are over 10 feet wide. They are huge. They are painted on fabric. They have collaged elements, but they focus on the pageantry of the marching band. Performers in full regalia, these kind of rhythmic patterns of figures going across the canvas, and at the center of each one is that drum major, who is, of course, the central figure, the action hero of every composition. But when you stand in front of these, you feel like you're enveloped in the action. You are part of it. You see figures coming from all directions, and they are brightly colored. But that is really the effect that the show has on you. And then in addition to those really large canvases, there are 15 portraits of each band's drum major. And for Keith Duncan, the artist, this is really the star performer. He grew up loving comic books, loving that feeling of the exaggerated action of the moment where you can tell how a figure is moving. And so many of these figures have learned steps that were passed down through their university that make them unique, symbolizing that university pride. So really those exaggerated motions are what he's trying to capture in these portraits.
And I wonder if one of you could talk a little bit more about the cultural importance of the HBCU band tradition, both kind of within HBCU culture, but larger as well. This is a big cultural influence, right?
It's an enormous cultural influence, and HBCU history is American history. Marching bands, as we think of them today, really originated in 1946 when Dr. William Foster incorporated dance steps, choreography, and showmanship into the Florida A&Ms, the Marching 100 routines. Before that, marching bands had really been more of a military tradition with this very staid carriage and emphasizing precision. And HBCUs injected that rapid tempo, the dancing, the choreography, the showmanship that we associate with marching bands today.
Kate, you're doing some outreach around this, and I'm looking particularly at a pair of outreach days coming up in October. Can you tell me a little about those?
Yes. So I came from art education, and one of the things that I really valued was the collaborative aspects of working with visual and performing arts teachers as a whole throughout the state. I think this exhibition provides an opportunity to connect all of those avenues together. So in October, on October 14th, and then again on October 21st, both Tuesdays, we're going to be offering band days, opportunities for students who are in bands, middle school to high school age, to come to the museum and experience this overlap with visual arts and performing arts and the expressiveness of it through this exhibition. In addition, offering opportunities for those students to engage with other aspects of performing arts into the college sphere, collaborating again with DSU a bit on that opportunity, bringing in local musicians and artists who create content that overlaps these different categories of visual performing arts, and showcasing that to the students, giving them ideas about career opportunities, expression opportunities, just avenues for creative beyond their current experience in the public school. So this is strictly a public school program right now. We're hoping to be able to fund schools and bring them here for these full day experiences and networking opportunities.
Looking at the 45 works in this exhibit, I wonder if each of you could just pick out one particular work that just really stands out to you, one particular work that really resonated with you.
So I went with Southern because Southern University is one of the two bands in the Battle of the Bands, also known as the Bayou Classic, which is held annually around Thanksgiving in New Orleans. It's also known as the Black Super Bowl. It's a two-day event between Grambling's world-famed Tiger Marching Band and Southern's Human Jukebox. And the reason I'm drawn to Southern is, one, I love the colors. It is bright blue. It is bright yellow. These are some of my personal favorite colors. The marching band painting that goes with it is actually the cover of the exhibition catalog. And when you walk in the show, is the first thing you see as you look down the long hallway of our show. The drum major is hidden off to the side a little, but he is in full regalia. He's got the high stepping going on. He has in his hand his mace, and his whistle is in his mouth. So it's got all of the elements that you expect from a drum major. And it is, again, mid-action. It looks almost like he's flying, that he's in such motion.
And Kate, what about you?
So I actually, when I first found out about this show, I was working with Dover High. Dover High's jazz band has come to the museum and done a few events here. Shalay Horn is the band director over there, and she is an alumni of Del State, was in the band at Del State. And I remember growing up, I went through private school. I didn't have the football team environment. So I used to go to Dover High football games, and I loved watching the drum majors. And the piece of the Howard University drum major just reminds me of a few things. So I actually sent this image to her when I knew the show was coming and said, you know, this is something you have to bring your students to. And there's a couple things about the piece that bring back sort of nostalgic memories for me of growing up in Dover, hearing Del State's marching band playing as you're, you know, driving down 13. I could hear it from my parents' house growing up, especially Saturday mornings before the games. Then there's the colors of the Howard drum major, this blue, red, and white, kind of tying back to that experience. And then the background on this image is like a picnic table. So it just gives that whole feeling of, you know, tailgates and food and movement and sound all sort of leading up to this experience of the football game for me.
I like to ask curators and art people that I talk to about exhibitions, artists and all, about what they hope the takeaway is from this exhibition. And in this case, I sort of want to ask this in two parts, one for each of you. And Laura, I want to ask you first about what you hope the broad takeaway for people who see this art is. And then I want to turn to you, Kate, and specifically ask about what you hope the takeaway is for young people who see this work. So let me start with you, Laura, and ask kind of about the broad takeaways.
Sure. Well, I hope that folks who come to the show reconnect with those memories, because everybody has an experience of being around a marching band, of going to a football game, of the pageantry of the halftime show, that in some cases that is actually more exciting than the game itself, not to diminish what the football players are doing. But one thing we're doing in the show that I really like is we have response stations throughout the galleries where people can share some of those memories with each other. So what do you hope to experience in this exhibit? The first time I heard a marching band, I felt, and then people can add their response. What I find valuable about experiencing music is, and then people can add their response. And I am curious to see that collaborative element evolve where people share memories, read other people's memories, and bring the community together through marching bands, because that is something that connects us all.
And Kate, what about specifically for the under 18 crowd, the students who are going to see this work?
I hope it encourages them to see the overlap between the fields of visual art and performing arts and really understand that they are very well integrated and, you know, experiencing them together as you're growing up and learning about the creative avenues. It's going to open a lot of doors for collaboration and community building. So I think that that's really important. In addition, you know, when we're drafting those response stations, I think it's super valuable to allow other people to connect together through shared experience or new experiences. So having more community members in conversation with each other, especially different age groups in conversation with each other, sharing the value of experiences is really important for every exhibition I think that we'll do.
And then finally, the exhibition opens on September 4th, and a week later on the 11th, there's a reception. Tell me a little bit about that.
I believe it is for Biggs Museum members only. So we are, encouraging people to become members of the Biggs. We have a free membership opportunity for folks in the community so they can be part of these experiences and stay in the loop with what's going on at the Biggs Museum. We'll have live music. There'll be food. There'll be opportunities for obviously viewing the work and experiencing the space and how it's going to transform with these pieces, which is something I think the Biggs Museum has never really experienced, is pieces at this scale with this kind of color, and it's going to be wonderful.
And if you are interested in attending that opening on September 11th, the Explorer level membership is free to sign up for on our website. You get added to our mailing list. You get an invitation to members only opening receptions, and then you get discounts at local eateries. So I think that's a great option to try and interact with the museum more. And it is, I think, rare for museums to have these multi-sensory exhibitions, that it's not just visual, that we're bringing in the sound, the music. So it's, I think, going to be a great event to come to.
Thanks to Biggs Museum Director of Learning and Engagement, Kate Huffman, and Biggs Chief Curator, Laura Fravell, as well as our Martin Matheny, for joining us on Arts Playlist. The exhibition Battle of the Bands opens September 4th with a members' reception September 11th. More information is available at biggsmuseum.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where our University of Delaware summer intern takes a look at how UD is prepping for the start of a new chapter for its football team. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. 2025 marks the University of Delaware football program's transition to FBS football following its invitation to join Conference USA. The change is an important milestone for UD, elevating the Blue Hens to the highest level of competition in NCAA football. However, it also presents UD with some challenges as it navigates unfamiliar terrain. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's University of Delaware summer intern Brendan Patterson reports on how the UD Athletic Department is meeting those challenges.
The 2025 season puts the Blue Hens on a new path. Gone are the days of being one of the bigger fish in the Football Championship Subdivision, or FCS, with aspirations of making the playoffs and competing for an NCAA championship. In the Football Bowl Subdivision, otherwise known as FBS, Delaware is an underdog and in its first year will be ineligible for its new goals, a Conference USA title and a postseason bowl bid, goals it can shoot for starting in 2026. The Blue Hens have been laying the groundwork for the change since accepting an invitation to Conference USA in 2023. While some other UD sports will compete in Conference USA, football is the headliner, and UD's decision to make the jump is a bold one. Jordan Skolnick is UD's interim director of athletics.
You know, it's a really exciting moment for us because this is an opportunity for our whole university to be able to get more exposure and more visibility. And so we've, really been able to think through a lot of different mediums and channels that we have to connect with people to get them excited about this change from FCS to FBS and going to Conference USA, and really aligning our athletics with the great academics that are here at the university.
Despite the opportunity to generate increased interest in UD football and the university, the promotion to Conference USA comes with some changes at odds with UD football tradition, including the loss of some of UD's long-standing rivalries. While some will remain through non-conference games, a number of the Blue Hens' most important rivalries, such as Villanova, will fall dormant. The Blue Hens will also contend with playing some weeknight games, deviating from their standard Saturday game days of the past. This year, four of UD's games will be played on days other than Saturday, and two midseason games will be played on Wednesday nights, including an October 22nd home game with Western Kentucky. Rob Barrow, director of the Blue Hen Touchdown Club fan organization, realizes these types of shifts can be hard for some to accept, especially for some old guard fans.
So there are some that are resistant to the change. They think that we should be a small time program and just be good at that, be good at small time football, Division II, FCS, whatever you want to call it.
It's also a dynamic that could reduce interest in attendance initially among UD students. News Journal Delaware Online sports reporter Kevin Tresolini has covered Blue Hen football for over 25 years and is a UD alum. He is uncertain if students will rally to weeknight games and opponents like Middle Tennessee and Louisiana Tech.
Well, they certainly need to respond better than they have. I mean, I've been really disappointed in Delaware students' response to the athletic teams.
But the changes are not all challenges. There are also opportunities to build a stronger fan base. The Hens will play more games against high-profile teams that fans recognize. This year, they travel to face Colorado and its head coach, Deion Sanders, while hosting UConn. Future schedules include Penn State, Virginia, Maryland, Pittsburgh, and Indiana. They will also see the return of past rivals, James Madison and Temple.
We've got UConn and JMU and Buffalo and Temple, Coastal Carolina, all those teams scheduled to come to Delaware Stadium. And that renewal of rivalries from a non-conference standpoint is something that I think people are really, really excited about.
And those weeknight games, they will be on national TV, broadcast by ESPN. Getting on ESPN is one of the biggest wins for Delaware to come out of joining Conference USA, allowing fans from all over the country to view Blue Hen games from the comfort of their living room. And their games will also be on ESPN Plus, which Barrow sees as a major upgrade from paying to stream games on Flow Sports, as fans needed to do up until now.
Turning on ESPN or ESPN Plus or whatever and saying, hey, the Hens are on, and being an alumni that, say, lives in New York or Florida or whatever, they could be like, okay, we're on here. We're on TV. Let's watch the game. You know, I think that's really going to help the program a lot. And I think it's going to bring more crowds to the games as well.
Skolnick also sees ESPN as a way to draw students to UD games, offering a chance to show off their UD pride on a much bigger stage.
Now they get to be on national TV, so I can't wait to see some of our students painting their faces and having signs and really making it fun. And I know Delaware students are going to rise to that occasion.
And Skolnick says UD also plans to do its part to create an atmosphere that students and other fans want to be a part of whenever the Hens take the field at Delaware Stadium.
Yeah, so one of the new things this year is called the flight path. And so we're going to have the team, the bus is going to drop off the team in front of our hospitality space that is it's powered by the Shell Brothers. It's called the Hen House. And we'll have that, and the team will walk out. We'll have the band. We'll have Spirit, you know, cheer, mascot, all down there. So we're hoping that people are going to come down there to be able to, you know, welcome the team as they come into the stadium and then get ready for the game.
It's clear that with the move up to Conference USA that UD is diving headfirst into deeper waters. But seasoned Blue Hen observers like Barrow and Tresolini think now is the time for the shift. FCS served its purpose for a time, but UD is ready to take the FBS plunge. And they agree. If they're right, UD fans will get on the bandwagon.
I'm not sure how well it's going to do at very first, you know, when we do this. But I think as people recognize, as long as we're winning games, I think people will recognize that, hey, Delaware's there, and maybe that'll spur like the average guy from like Middletown or Smyrna or Dover or Wilmington or whatever to say, hey, we got a college football team here now. Let's go to the games.
How many games they win will be the indicator. And I certainly think they have the capability to win several this year.
Skolnick is optimistic, too. He's seen the work the players are putting in and says they and all those supporting them are waiting with bated breath for the chance to show Delaware what they're made of.
There is more that's the same than is different. You know, they are ready to go and compete to win games. That doesn't change.
I'm Brendan Patterson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Brendan, for this story and all of your work this summer at DPM. The Blue Hens opened their season this Thursday, August 28th, against Delaware State in Newark. Their first official FBS game is at Colorado, September 6th, and their first Conference USA game is at Florida International, September 20th. The And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. You can find the stories and interviews you've heard online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show happen, University of Delaware intern Brendan Patterson, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry, Martin Matheny, and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.